I met Jeff about 15 years ago, and took me back to school and showed me and my family. We went through it, and he showed me what he was doing. And there's so much that I could describe about that. That basically meant that he took responsibility for their lives in 100 square blocks of Harlem. Right in the center of Harlem, he takes responsibility for the lives in partnership with Stan Druckenmiller, a great philanthropist and a partner. They all decided that they're going to do this thing. So a very big, audacious goal of taking responsibility for their lives, because if you get to know that community and what it's like, it is not just a matter of going to school. It is a matter of the total, you know, the parents, the shootings, the issues, that all of that that ends up being the traumas that are their total lives that they don't have the benefit of dealing with. So he took 100 square blocks of Harlem and whatever, and he described what he was doing, and he demonstrated what he was doing, which was basically to take care of their lives. And he said it was, I think he described it as like a 16-year plan, that he said, I'll take them right from the beginning, and then we'll take them through that, and that'll be their community, and then they will go to college. And because it's their community, they will come back and they will be doctors and they will be lawyers in that community and they will be part of that. And that's not wasn't just his vision. That was the reality that he actually delivered, you know. And I and my family and I related very much to this. And so he and I became friends over this period of time. I'll just go, you know, quick story, because it's just so many stories, take you forward. And I said, this man is a shaper. We have a kick together. We enjoy each other, but this man is a shaper. Okay. What I mean by a shaper is somebody who can visualize and then build out that reality, a unique reality. And this man's a shaper. So you might find in my book, I was saying, okay, I want to find a shaper. How do I find a shaper? So I gave shaper tests to, what are the psychological profiles of Jeff Canada, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Muhammad Yunus in different areas, because he's a shaper. He's a demonstrated shaper. So, and I watched that. And over that period of time evolved over, my wife started about 10 years ago to get involved with the same population in Connecticut, of going to those schools and dealing with that population. And as a result, you know, I'd come home at the dinner table every night, and she would describe the circumstances that they're dealing with, and we'll go into that. But they're unimaginable circumstances. Most of you don't know those circumstances, even though they're right around the corner. Like, you go for 10 minutes away, and you can come into Bridgeport or a town like that, and you don't see those circumstances. And those circumstances include abject poverty, shootings, gangs, things that you would never let no civil society would let that fall below that kind of level. Anyway, I would hear that on a regular basis, and I got deeply involved. And so, and we've been, you know, in this, talking about this and what we want to do together. So that's a little bit of background. I don't want to take too much time, but I wanted to just give you a little bit of framing. This man is a shaper. So I'd like you to know a little bit, if we can come out of here with what I'd like to accomplish. I'd like you to know a little bit about the man and the shaper, and I'd like you to also know a little bit more about the circumstances, the general circumstances. And I'd like to look them beyond those general circumstances to say, okay, what do we all do about that? Or do you ignore it? So a little bit about the man is, and why he's a hero. And by the way, I would say, you don't know the heroism that a lot of the successful people who have come through these communities, what real heroes are. In his case, his dad left him when he was something like 4. And he was lucky enough to have a great mom. And then through that guidance and so on, he had his evolution. We're going to touch on that in a minute. And I'm lucky enough also to know a number of other people. Like I say, I know Sean Combs, Diddy. And he is a hero of mine. And we might not think of these people as heroes. They're the greatest heroes because they have had to overcome the greatest obstacles and have gotten there and developed the greatest character to then do great and generous things to help other people. So I want you to get to know Jeff a little bit. Then I want us to go into what the community is like and the circumstances that are being faced there. And then I want to go back to what to do about it. So Jeff, let's go into your story.
Okay.
You tell it. Yeah, your dad left at 3.
I was going to say, you tell it, Ray. All right.
I wasn't there.
So I mean, this, look. So one of the things that I'm obsessed with is this issue of how you can be in America, you can be a good person, God-fearing, care about your community, do everything that you're supposed to do to show you're of good character, and have not a clue of how folk just a short distance away are living. So it's funny, Ray, this is when I realized that my world had changed. We were living in the Bronx, and my mother lost her job, and we lived in this nice, quiet community, and we moved to a community. When you looked out, we were on the front of the building. We looked out, it was a 6-story walk up. We looked out the window, all these kids were out there. And I said, how is it that your mother loses her job and you actually end up in a better community? Well, little did I know that the kids downstairs, we were out there and we were waving, because I had 3 brothers. So it's 4 of us, we're in a new block and we're waving out the window. And kid looks up at us, rubs his fist in his eye and points at us. And I look at my brothers and I'm like, that didn't look so friendly. And so we waved a little bit more tentatively, did exactly the same thing. And I said, I think those kids are going to beat us up. So then, now, single mom, we're in a new place. All my brothers, they look at me because I had the best relationship with my mother. They say, you got to go tell mom. So I go in and say, mom, those kids want to beat us up. And so here's my mother's biggest fear. I'm raising 4 boys, no father. We're in the city. They have to grow up and have independence. They can't. She was like, those boys aren't going to beat you up. You guys are scared. Y'all go down here and make friends. I said to my brothers, mom ain't going to help us with this. We got a problem. And the deal was, before you could come downstairs and play, you had to go fight. And none of us knew how to fight. We didn't know anything about fighting. But your choice was either stay in the house or go fight. So I'm trying to figure this thing out. And then this is when it hit me that I was in an alternative universe. My mom didn't make very much money. She sent my brother out with $10, which was like probably 30% of her weekly income. And he was robbed in the hallway. They took the $10. And that meant we weren't going to be able to make it through the week. And so we called the police. And so I'm standing, and the police show up, and we're explaining what happened, and just the absolute sort of disregard. They looked and said, you called us for $10, and you expect us to do what? And I was like, get fingerprints, go do stuff, right? This is money. They made it clear they had zero interest in helping us, that we were on our own. And I realized we were on our own with no one to protect us. I spent the next 10 years trying to develop a set of skills that I could protect the family. You have to remember, my mother would be walking down the street. Men could say the most obscene things to her, right? And she would have kids with her. And you would just sit there and you'd want to be able to stand up and fight. But I was like 8. What are you going to do? And I just sat there saying, at some point, I'm going to get enough power to protect my mother. I wasn't interested in the academic kind of power. I was interested in physical. How do you go out and physically protect yourself? And I realized young people growing up where violence is ever present. For us to really believe that they're going to be able to spend time preparing academically like kids who aren't doing that is just simply not true. The other part of this came out in Waiting for Superman. Look, when Davis Guggenheim, when that documentary was finished, for about 5 months. It didn't have a name. I'd call them every day. What's going on? What's with the name? And they were trying to figure out what to call it. And finally, he told me, we're going to call it Waiting for Superman, because they took that from a statement I made in the film, which was true. I was a huge comic book reader. Only DC Comics, no Marvel. That's how old I am. Marvel wasn't even invented then. And when my mother, I must have been about 8 or 9, my mother told me there was no Superman, and I began to cry. And she thought I was crying because there's no Easter Bunny. Right? Oh, I was crying because my last hope of making it out of the South Bronx was that here was this superhero who came in and always at the last minute saved the good people. And when I realized there was no superhero, I knew nobody was going to save us in that community. And people look at me and say, but Jeff, you got out. Yeah, but I had 3 other brothers. Only one of them made it out healthy. The other one died. One is still struggling. My wife is from Harlem. She had 4 sisters and brothers. None of them made it past 25. The toll. And this is the physical toll. People aren't there. But the emotional toll. Do you know what it's like to lose people when you're so young and you grow up in a world thinking you don't know about tomorrow? You don't know about the future. Young people growing up in that kind of environment have so many things against them. As you can imagine, Ray, I've spent the rest of my life trying to figure out how we help those young people make it so they can live in a country that the rest of us experience, which is a great country if you're in certain zip codes. It's not such a great country if you're in other zip codes.
Yeah, I just want to, I'm very lucky through my wife and so on to have exposure to this that we all don't see, and it's just right around the corner. And there are lists here, and the statistics of something like 20-some-odd% had somebody close to them shot or killed. In Hartford, Connecticut, the capital here, kids cannot go to school, walk to school without walking through areas of gangs that they can be shot. And my wife asks the mayor of, why can't police assure safe passage? Well, they only have 275 policemen, because that's all they can afford, because I got to cut down on this or cut down on that. And something like 38% of them have family members who are incarcerated. And so, and it's all of that. And so when I say heroism, I'd say heroism is overcoming your obstacles. And so you look like a man like him. And you say, when you'll get to know him, and you look at that and you say that. But he was blessed. He was blessed because he had a mom who was a great mom and who loved him, who we happen to speak to today. And when you look at that, and we look at the particular cases, the trauma, I think what you need to understand, and what I've come to understand, is that it's very difficult at a very early age, the trauma, the post-traumatic stress that a child receives at a very, very early age, unless they have that kind of mother. So you were lucky. But tell me, because now you have your whole population. He took responsibility for all the kids in 100 square blocks of Harlem. Tell us more of what it's like and how you do it.
So, it's fascinating because you mentioned my mother. My mother made an investment when we were young, that we were the only kids that I knew on our block. She couldn't really afford to do this, but she got the World Book Encyclopedias. Now, most of you all have no idea what that is, right? But if you were growing up in the 50s, the only way you could really get in one place everything going on in the world was if you bought a set of encyclopedias, right? It started at A and ended at Z, right? Aardvark was the first thing that you ran into, right? But if you think about it, today, right, everybody has 10,000 times more information on their phones. When I grew up, if you didn't have access to some sort of comprehensive set of encyclopedias. You actually didn't understand anything about the world. You were growing up knowing nothing. Because of that investment, I actually had my whole world expanded. I think we were going to go through A to Z. I think we got through N, right? We never made it through the last part because, I mean, they were really full books. But every time I opened up that book, I learned something about a world that was not the world I was living in. In fact, the one thing I couldn't find was anything about the world I was living in, right? They didn't write about that. No one published it. And so for me, I began to understand that my experience was not the experience of lots of folks in this country. So if you look at what we decided to do and the why behind it, my board, you know Stan, and they're all numbers guys. A lot of folks from hedge funds are on the board. And they all kept saying to me, Jeff, if we've got to spend money, what's the most efficient way for us to do it? What years should we invest in that's going to make the most difference in a kid's life? And I kept looking at the research, and the more I looked at the research, the more it said from birth, right through when you get them in college. And I began to say that, and they were like, no, 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 you can't do everything, Jeff, you can't do everything. Figure out the time period that's the most important. And this went on for a couple of years, and let me tell you how we ended up solving this. I finally got to my board members, and I said, all right, let me turn that question around. You have kids? Yep. You have a spouse? Yo, yeah, we're both college educated. You live in a nice place, wonderful. And your kids go to great schools? Yes. When could you drop out of their life for 4 years? When they're young? No, no, God, no, Jeff, not when they're young. You can't. Well, how about when they get to middle school? Oh, my goodness, you know what happened? High school, oh, drugs and sex. And so I said, so why are kids coming from the best neighborhoods, the best families, that you all are afraid to go away for a weekend, right? And you expect us to drop out of our kids' lives for years and their life is going to be fine? And they said, you know what? I think you have a point. There is no, you know, the most important time in a kid's life? Today. Today. That's when you save them. You can't decide if I do something between 0 to 3, their life is going to be fine. Not if they're growing up in one of these communities, because there are so many obstacles that can trip you up. It's not just academic obstacles. There's the drugs, there's the crime, there's the violence, there's depression, there's mental health issues. All of these things impact young people in a way that interferes with their ability to do well. And we want to celebrate the ones who get out, right? Oh, yeah, look, they're wonderful. They went to an Ivy League school, and that's great. But all I can think about are all the ones who never had a chance to get out. So we start from birth. Something we call baby college. We help parents understand brain development because that stuff is real. As I tell folks, my wife Yvonne and I, we have 4 kids. Our oldest is 50 and our youngest is 22. There was like a 20-year gap. At the time, we thought it was a good idea. You know, you know how you're sitting around, when y'all don't know. You're sitting around one day, oh, raising those kids, that wasn't that hard. You forget why you should have kids while you're young. But what happened during that interim is that we found out about 0 to 3. We found out about all that's going on in those young brains that we didn't really realize a lot was happening, but now we know. This toxic stress that you're talking about, it not only has impact emotionally today, the evidence is becoming clearer that it impacts your physical health as you develop and as you grow. So this thing doesn't go away. So I'm thinking about all of these kids growing up traumatized. And how are we trying to create a world for them where they have this different set of expectations? And I'll just tell you one of the things that happened. So I'm with my youngest kid. He's 22 now, but he was only about 12 then. And we're visiting one of our schools. And every morning the kids come up and they have to say their creed. And the end of their creed is, I will go to college. I will succeed. This is my promise. This is my creed. So here we're in the hallway. Like hundreds of kids are lined up. And my young son, and they're saying this, he looks at me and he says, Dad, you're brainwashing these kids. And I say, yep, that's what I'm doing. And so this year at graduation, a group of kids that started with us at Baby College, were graduating, right? It's 20 years later. They're graduating high school, and they say that same creed that they've been saying their whole educational experience. And indeed, that's what we're trying. We're trying to set a set of attitudes and beliefs that's supported by action, not just good words. How do we help you overcome these obstacles so these young people have a shot in our great city in New York?
Tremendous accomplishments and ain't nothing in the context of the size of the problem. Okay, so we talk about this. I said, okay, Jeff, that was great, but like, how are you going to deal with this? Because my wife and I are dealing with Connecticut.
We're dealing with Connecticut.
Okay, so Connecticut. I don't know if you know, but my wife for the last 10 years has been in that community and helping out, and she's, I won't go on at length, but we've created a mission beyond what she's doing to put, we'll make a $100 million donation, they will make $100 million state. We put together this group of wonderful people that is bipartisan, so on, to try to take on, to get high school kids who would drop out through high school and into a job, which is not an easy thing because they not only get them through high school, but who is their community and what's their path to an income? Their community is largely can be gangs and whatever that is. And getting a job is not like, hey, you can make money other ways. Yeah. And he knows this very well. And so to work through that, and that one of the reasons Jeff is here is because we're brainstorming. I'm like, Jeff, how do we do this thing? And so when I'm looking at that, I'd say that was unbelievable. 100 square blocks. Okay. But that ain't nothing in relationship to the issue. Okay, so we try to Connecticut. Okay, that ain't nothing.
Yeah.
And then so I was asking him, okay, so what are you going to do to have a kind of big impact? Okay, how do you deal with that problem?
Yeah.
So Jeff, what are you going to do? How are you
going to
deal with that problem?
So Ray and I know one another well enough that what he said, which was, that was great, but that ain't nothing. And not many people have discussed my career in that way. that was great, but that ain't nothing. But he's right. He's right. Because it's one thing if you don't know, right? And there are a lot of people who don't know. They just don't honestly know what's happening. When you actually know what's happening and you believe, honestly, there's an answer, and you don't do everything in your power to try and share that with this country, I think that is a huge, huge error. And I am convinced that Ayatollah Stan, I had retired, and I told him my mission is to help at a minimum an additional million children in this country reach this next level. So I was working with a group at Blue Meridian Partners with another entity. You know most of the folks on there, the Bombers and some of the other folks. And we were thinking about the country and our biggest challenge with this work. So Ray and Barbara, they're going to put up $100 million to help Connecticut. That is great. And one of the reasons, and it's a drop in the bucket, but one of the reasons I wanted to come here, I didn't know I was talking to you all, because I didn't come here to talk to you all, but that's great. I'm glad you all are here. I came because this issue about how is it that we make this Connecticut effort successful, because one of the things we did at the Harlem Children's Home, we proved it could be done in a neighborhood, but no one has proved it can be done in a state. And if we're going to scale things, we've got to go out and show folks that these things are being. So I have a real vested interest in trying to help Barbara be successful in what she's trying to do. But the big issue is that this should be part of a public funding strategy. So public dollars being spent in a more efficient and effective way, delivering at scale what we know works with kids. An issue came up, I explained to Ray, and I won't tell you all the insides and outsides, but Mike Bloomberg, I've known for many years. When he was mayor of New York City, we did a lot of the education reform stuff together. And Mike wanted me to help with his campaign. And for lots of reasons, I didn't want to go out and be identified with one candidate more than another because I'm associated with the Harlem Children's Zone. And I don't want people to think the Harlem Children's Zone is playing sides. But I thought there's one thing that would get me to really support Mike. And if that's if he put $10 billion in a federal program, if he gets elected, to help us do this work around the country. So I went to Mike and I said, I'm with you if you'll do $10 billion in a federal program that does these kind of replications where we're holding people accountable, but we're not afraid to invest in places that's had this massive disinvestment historically. And Mike and his team said yes. So I'm not here to do a political commercial. I just want you to know, if you see me on TV going on and on, what the deal is. I personally think, because this has been an issue.
You
right?
mentioned win or lose.
And I did. I don't want to necessarily get so public because I don't want to put Mike in a bad place. But the issue since Ray has mentioned it, the issue that I said with Mike was because what happens if I do all of this to try and help him get elected and then he ends up dropping out or not winning the nomination? And I said, with the amount that you're willing to spend and your influence, will you back this program, win or lose? This program is directly tied to the most at-risk communities in this country, particularly communities of color. And Mike said that he would do it, win or lose, that this is something he's going to back.
Whoa.
And I guess I just did a commercial. I was trying to do a commercial.
Okay.
But that's real. And you can look it up because he mentioned it out loud in public that he was doing this, so that this is not just between us here. It is publicly out there now.
Raising $10 billion for that. That's big.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, I think for, you know, my wife, who, as you and Barbara know, because y'all have met her, is a deeply religious lady. And she has said to me, Jeff, if you're going to do something like this, make sure if you get what you want, it's enough. And my sense is part of what a lot of us in this space do, we do whatever we think we can afford, but it may not be enough to actually get the job done. And my belief is, that this is like investing in anything else, in my opinion. If you know it's going to take this investment to be successful and you invest here, well, what do you expect is going to happen, right? It's not going to work. And we've been doing that in this space, working in poverty, for all the years of my career. People have not been prepared to invest. Now, part of it is they don't believe certain things work. But once we know something works, why won't we do the kind of investment? Because people tend to not believe these communities are worth that kind of an investment. And I think that's un-American.
Yeah, a couple of things come to mind. First of all, you could see what an unbelievable man he is, right? And what a really great hair, the quality of the character and so on. And I don't think almost anybody could get like that if they didn't have to go through the obstacles and they didn't have a love of the parent and the guidance in order to do that. And I want to say, like, when I know other people, I could say others, I'd like to bring others in here who are, and so that we realize what incredible heroes they are, so that we look up to them and some of as the greatest heroes. And also they need heroes, that population, they need the role models, because I'm saying I'm in awe of that. Like I'm saying, Sean Combs, same story, and the white community doesn't know that. And his father was killed at 2. Okay, he had a great mother. His mother worked 3 jobs, had to do this, and there are many like that. And you will never get that type of character by coming through a normal, like, let's say, okay, you live in Greenwich, Connecticut, you rate them, you can raise good kids.
But wow, those are heroes, right? And so they need to be recognized as heroes and also as role models. How do we do that better?
Yeah, I think you brought up one of the issues. When you think about sort of, look, we're in America. It's a capitalist country. It's the greatest economic system I think ever invented. But it tends to assume that your value is based on how much you've earned and not necessarily what you've done in your life. Right. And so I think there's this real disconnect because there are people. I mean, one of the things that stunned me in my early heroes are the folk who actually knew they were sacrificing their life and they still did it anyhow. And I thought that, you know, Dr. King, and I thought it was accidental. They knew. He got every week he was warned. They are coming to get you. They're going to kill you. And, you know, I tell folks, one of my biggest heroes is Harriet Tubman. You all know Harriet, right? And I tend to think I was brave. But the day I was friends with Harriet and she said, Jeff, I got this idea, right? I want to go back down south and I'm going to go get some. And I'm thinking, they're not just going to kill you. They're going to torture you. I'd be like, can't we write an op-ed or something, Harry? Do we have to? I like to think maybe I would have done it once, over and over. So for me, there are people who have done things in this country that just go unnoticed because we don't put ourselves in their place. We actually don't think, in that same circumstance, would I would have done that? And to me, trying to live up to some of these heroes and heroines. I'll just give you one other example that really vexes me. Any of you see Hidden Figures?
Yeah.
Now, look, you have to realize, I was a teenager when we were trying to win this war to go to space. Do you know what it would have done to the black community to know these black women were considered computers? Do you know how many black students would have majored in math if they thought they had seen a symbol of this? Keeping this kind of stuff intentionally away from a group of people undermines their belief in themselves.
Well,
you don't see the examples.
How to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, to make that, because that is a whole thing. I want to look up to you.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go to a couple of questions. Let's open it up for questions.
In kind of outcome space, you talk about success and getting people, you know, kids all the way through into college. A lot of the times when I start to wrap my head around the problem that you've tackled your whole career, it starts to feel like squeezing a balloon because you're kind of like, all right, everywhere I go, there's another problem that pops up or it's somewhere else you have to go solve it. But can you talk a little bit about how you really think about success and what outcomes you shoot for?
Yeah, so that's a great question because I am very clear on what our outcomes are, which is kids graduating with a degree getting connected to the labor market. The evidence of what happens to communities when jobs disappear. One of the seminal books that changed my way of thinking about this is written by, I think probably one of the greatest sociologists, happened to be African-American, William Julius Wilson. His book, When Work Disappears, talked about what happened in Chicago when jobs left. There was a study that just came out that looked at what happened when factories closed just recently. And they were looking, and guess what happened? Substance abuse, suicides, depression, child abuse, divorce, all of the stuff that became associated with the poor inner cities, African Americans, happens everywhere. Folks begin to lose jobs. It actually breaks up the fabric of community because we haven't said to people, you're something different than the job you hold. We define ourselves by what we do. And when you lose that definition, you fall prey to all the other social evils in the world. So my outcomes are very clear. A kid with a degree and a decent job. That's what I care about. So do I care about third grade tests? Yes. But You could do great in the third grade, but that doesn't mean anything to me if 10 years from now, right, you're standing on that corner, right, hustling, and you're not on your way going into school. So we've got about 940 of our kids in college, about 800 of our kids have graduated. We're focusing on connecting these kids with jobs because it is like squeezing a balloon. And my board, you sound like a board member of mine for a while. They kept saying, when does it end, right? And I said, well, it ended when we got them in college. Well, guess what? We looked at the data. They were dropping out of college. No, we got to help them get through. And then we like, okay, you're good. And then you know what we found out? You're good, but you have no contacts, nobody to call, no way to figure out how to get a job, an interview, and the rest of that stuff. So we said, we got to do more to connect them to this. And then when they came to me for graduate school, I said, hey, guys, it's over. All right? You're done. You figure the rest of this out on your own, right? You've got a degree. But I'm being serious about this. To me, this is about getting a generation, right, all with a set of experiences. And people push back against this college thing with me. But this is because we send about 90% of our kids to college, but we get 98% of them into college. And my thing is, I don't want any kid to say, I took this job because I didn't think I was smart. Getting into college just means that somebody thought you were smart enough to go to college, which is a self-definition. And I think that prepares you to think about work and not thinking about hustling, which is where a lot of our kids default to when they try and think about how am I going to make a living.
What Jeff has done is a remarkably successful version of this. I want to say that from studying these things, it's like if we could just only give like three things, right? The three things is a parent or a mentor who cares about them.
Yep.
Okay. It's almost a defining thing. A good basic education.
Yep.
Like, you know, I didn't grow, and then kind of a non-violent, poverty and trauma. And the society pays an enormous price. Not only is it unjust, but the society pays an enormous price for that. We're going to go through the accounting of it, but we really believe that it's going to be so profitable. Because the state of Connecticut pays $600 million a year for incarceration costs.
Yeah.
So when you start to take the all in, aside from the human tragedy, if you just can deal with that, the return on investment economically and the fairness of it, we haven't talked about how it's possible to not create an acceptable bottom. And by the way, this isn't just a black community thing. This goes on in education programs. The average, I looked at these quintiles, top 20, next 20%, and so on. Top 40% of the population, their kids' education is five times as much money per capita as the bottom 60% of the population.
Yeah.
So you look at a cycle, and it really should be remediation should be the other way in order to do it, because they would need extra to overcome.
Yep.
So we as a population are getting almost what we deserve almost. So what are your thoughts about how that, what should happen?
Yeah, it's fascinating because I've been getting a lot of pushback around the criminal justice issues. On one end, supporting Mike because of stop and frisk, which I fussed at him for a long time around. But part of what happened, and this is part of what was happening, people forget what was going on during the crack epidemic that happened in the late 70s, early 80s. The murder rates were off the chart. People were trying to figure out what we're going to do. There was this belief, and it was just bad social science. There was a belief that what we were missing was a get-tough approach on crime, and that was going to be the answer. So we started locking people up, and we did so in a discriminatory fashion, right? We were locking up African-Americans for having small amounts of drugs, and we weren't even searching white Americans. So where you police is where you arrest. And no one put those two things together. And we ended up locking up hundreds of thousands of folks for the most minor of things. And that has created, I think, this huge sort of group of folks who are off the labor rolls because they've got felony arrest. And it's staggering, the numbers, in particular in African-American and Latino men.
I had a situation where I knew somebody, and what he did is he came home, he had a hot temper, and didn't hit his wife, yelled at his wife. Neighbor said, okay, called in the police. Had him arrested, need to calm down. He couldn't go to work that night. Yeah. He was working a hard worker, you know, like a shift, like from 3 a.m. to 10 a.m. or something. Lost his job. I mean, these are hurdles that are tough hurdles.
They're tough, and by the way, and they're the most expensive. We opted out for something. People always talk about what it costs to save a kid, and you know, it costs us about $3,000 on top of the school stuff for kids and families. And people would always argue about me about affording that. Right. And then I would say, but you look around the country, the average incarceration rate, right, nationally, about 30%, $30,000. New York State's about 60. You can't even, I guarantee you don't know what it costs to lock somebody up for a year in New York City. 300,000 now. I used to say 147, but what happened was we reduced the population, but it didn't reduce the cost. So now the cost per person is skyrocketing. I've heard not one person ever say, we can't lock up any more people. One of these, so saving them is not scalable, but locking them up is scalable. That, to me, is just bad. Politics is bad science, and it's been devastating when that's done in a way that it hits one community, poor people of color, disproportionately, because it looks like we have a solution and there's no solution there. Yeah. And we've actually done harm and not good.
The studies that we've done, and I'll give you another statistic. Connecticut, so you're in Connecticut. There are disengaged and disconnected students. A disengaged student is one who goes to school but has an absentee rate of greater than 25% and is failing classes, so school's not working for them. A disconnected student is one that they don't know where they are. They've left the school system. 22% of the high school students in Connecticut are one of those. Okay, so they're gonna be out on the street. The economics of getting them between the 8th and 9th years is really measured in a few thousand dollars. But the incarceration costs are in the automatic every year or those other numbers. So how ain't it profitable? You have a question.
Yeah. So Ray's talked about having to walk by gangs on the way to school, and you've talked about having to fight in your neighborhood. How do you guys think, how do you think about looking after students when they're not in the classroom?
I mean that's a great question, because that's part of the essence of what we do. Our belief is that it is the out-of-school time where most kids get in trouble. And as I've told folks, I've yet to, you know, one of our buildings on 125th Street, I've yet to walk on 125th Street and see a group of kids reading Langston Hughes on the corner, right? I mean, I just never seen it, right? And so when kids are out of the watchful eye of caring adults, they sometimes do dumb things. Now, if you're 19, you're here at UConn, and you do something dumb. You probably overdrank, maybe threw up in the waste paper basket, etc. Right? You're on 125th Street and you're drunk, and someone comes up with a brilliant idea, let's go rob the Chinese restaurant, and you know, you do something stupid, there goes the rest of your life. Right? So part of this is limiting the amount of time my kids have to do stupid things, because we're watching them. And they all know, and a lot of us live in the community, so they all know we're always looking for signs that they're not, you know, living up to a set of expectations that we have for them. So I think this out-of-school time is critical. The programs are open in the evenings, on the weekends, in the summertime. We're trying to make sure that our kids are spending more time with us than any place else. Because, look, we all grew up, we all had parents. We didn't listen to everything they said, right? But the big stuff we tended to listen to, right? The little stuff, yeah, maybe we did some stuff. They said, come home, don't go with that person. But, you know, you didn't think maybe I'll get a gun and go hold somebody up, right? That wasn't in our consciousness. It is with kids who don't have caring adults around them. Kids do what their friends do. So if your friends are all hustling and getting high, guess what you're going to end up doing? The pressure to do that, I mean, no peer pressure, is going to overwhelm most kids. So we try to create environments where the pressure is the opposite. And that, I think, is all happens out of school time for where most of our kids are in our program.
We found after-school programs are great because the infrastructure is there. So the kids can just go right after, and they get really good mentorship and guidance so that they get good social influences as well as then education as well as taking them off the street. Yeah. After-school programs are a big good deal.
I'm just curious, in your program, which sounds fabulous, what are some of the other stakeholders in that and their thinking? So I'm thinking about the gangs, the police, especially when you first started. What were some of those obstacles and how they feel about your program in the middle of their community?
So this is a great question.
By the way, I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. Because I want to tell, he took his school, he built his school right in the middle of the projects in this spot. And the goodness that radiates from that school is an impressive thing to watch. But go ahead. I just wanted you to know that.
I didn't even realize that was a better story to tell than the one I was going to tell. It's going to go right to Ray from now on. So this is part of this is historical, right? So there's been this historical problem that African Americans have had with the police departments, right? And it's history. And in Harlem, in particular, there was something called the Dirty 30. The 30th precinct was right in the middle of Harlem. It was so corrupt that everybody knew they were in league with the drug dealers. So the last person you would call if you had a problem was going to be the police because they were with the criminals. Now, when we started our effort, they decided to clean out that entire precinct. And they replaced all of those. It's a big news story and everything. They replaced them with folks who actually were honest police officers. And they came to come in and said, hey, we want to help. No one believed them. No one trusted them. And so we couldn't have Harlem change if there wasn't actually adequate policing going on. So we were the intermediaries with the police department. The community members would talk to us. We talked to the police. And then they would see, and then after a while, they began to talk to the police themselves. Because part of the issue was folks in Harlem thought there was this really sophisticated network of criminals where they were smart and they were talking to one another, saying Jeff is old. It wasn't true. They're a bunch of knucklehead kids, right? Every now and then they would accidentally find out something. That was an issue. But we watched that whole situation turn on its head where now we have a really decent relationship with the police because they know, here's the other issue, they know that our kids are kids who are all on the right path. So there's this whole group of kids, oh, that may be a Harlem Children's Own kid, and we know they're trying to get the right thing. So it's not like the problem is solved for all the black people in Harlem, but it certainly has improved. But this issue Ray talks about is one that I think is important and one of the most important things we're going to do for this country. The housing projects have always, even in Harlem, the worst outcomes for our kids and families were in the housing projects. The most crime, a family of four was living on about $18,000 a year, which is New York City. It's just like unbelievable. About 60% of the folks had no working adult in the home. So we decided we wanted to build our brand new school right in the middle of that housing project. And it was controversial. The community, some of the residents, one of the council people, they were against charter schools and they made a big deal about it. And what we had said to folk is we're building this for you. They didn't believe us. Even me, they didn't believe me. They were like, you're not going to build a $100 million building for us. And they fought us. And my biggest opponent, this woman who lived in the housing projects, and everywhere we would go, ooh, the things this lady would say to me, I would tell you, I had to tell my staff, I know y'all think I'm special, but I'm not going to be special in this meeting when this woman gets a hold of me, right? And she tore me down. The day we opened that school and I showed all the kids from the housing project who were in the school, she came up to me afterwards and she said, Mr. Canada, you know who I am? I said, yeah, I know who you are. She says, I want to apologize. She says, I was wrong. My grandson was walking past the school and he told his older cousins who were like 18 and 19, I'm going to that school when it opens. And they were like, no, you're not. Don't say that. That cannot be your school. And she said, they never thought anybody would open up a school in the housing projects for us. And my grandson's in this school right now. And I, you know what? I recognize in these communities, there's a reason people are suspicious. There's a reason they're hostile. There's a reason they think people are going to take advantage of them because that's been their experience. And if you're doing the right thing, and I tell folks, don't think people are going to applaud and say how wonderful you are because there's a lot of suspicion, right, about what your motives are and why you're doing stuff. And I tell folk who often think, oh, you know, it's going to be tougher for me because I'm white. Oh, look, my wife was from Harlem. I lived in Harlem. That didn't mean nothing to anybody. They thought this was some attempt to exploit them. And even after we had spent 15 years demonstrating otherwise, people were still suspicious about this. So the person who stood up to all the community folks was the tenant president of St. Nicholas Houses. She understood why we were doing this, and she just said to everybody, wait to see what happens. I'm telling you, you can trust these guys. They're doing that for our kids. So now no one knows that history anymore. Building's been open 5 or 6 years. Everybody's there for Thanksgiving. We do a big Thanksgiving dinner for the community, and we do nice things around Christmas and the holidays. So everybody's like, oh, they're wonderful, they're wonderful. They didn't think that when this thing was happening. But that's just part of the challenges, I think, of working in communities. And I have said to folks, I'm sure Ray and Barbara have faced this, for every person who thinks you're doing something good, there's a person who has a belief that you're doing something that's selfish and just in your own interest, and they're being used and exploited. And there's nothing you can almost say to change that until they see the proof. And I kept telling my team, it's not until this building is open and folks come in that they're actually going to believe us. Up until then, we're just going to take the sort of anger that they're bringing towards us as a cost of doing business.
Yeah, like in Barbara's case, it's taken 10 years of being in the community, knowing the people, doing that, that builds trust. Yeah. So everybody bipartisan, you know, but still it takes education, because that's absolutely right. Yeah. You know, anyway, the what occurs to me is we must find a way to take whoever here wants to go either to Harlem Children's Zone or to go down to Bridgeport or whatever, and to show them what it is and what's going on.
The thing that I have found, and I absolutely believe that until you see it, you don't really get it.
That's right.
That folk come in and I talk about what we're doing. They're like, oh yeah, I love it, I love it, I love it. Every single time they walk in and they say, oh, now I really understand.
Right.
Now I really got it, right? So I just think if you care about these issues, I think one of the most important things that happened from our work, before we said we were going to try and, now you have to remember, the old Harlem, 30% of the buildings were abandoned, graffiti everywhere, trash all over the streets, open air drug markets everywhere. We said we're going to change this community, and people didn't believe you could do such a thing. They just simply didn't believe it. Now, gentrification has a different set of challenges, right, when that happened. But nobody ever thought Harlem could be gentrified. It was like Detroit. It was like Milwaukee. It was like all of these places that have been crumbling for decades. And one of the things that we want to say to folks is it is doable. It is not easy. It's not everybody can't do it, but it is doable. And those who can do it need to do it in places if you care about this country and you believe in America. That's what this, in theory, that's what this country stands for. We have to turn that theory into fact. And this is how I believe you can do it at scale.
Well, you can see why this man is a hero of mine, right? And is a hero, should be a hero of everybody and just recognized. So, you know, like we're waiting for Superman. You are our Superman, man. So thank you very much.